then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, your vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's April the 24th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
Good afternoon, comrades. I'm Olivia from Seattle. I recently received an article from a comrade regarding the murder of a white man in Southeast London, which sparked a lengthy conversation covering many topics, ranging from the race of the victim not being openly revealed, although watching the video, it was fairly easy to see that the victim was white, to rednecks, guns, and racism, and finally ending up on spirituality, religion, honor, and integrity. Although we touched on many things throughout the conversation, some of which are very important and really do need to be said, aired out, and worked through, the thing that stood out for me as most important at this point in time was the topic of honor and integrity. The point of this particular conversation had nothing to do with religion or spirituality, but I found the timing interesting in light of the fact that I had recently been doing some research on white religious beliefs, where I found references to honor and integrity being an integral part of who white people are and a main component of their societies and how they practice their spirituality and religion when they are at the top of their game. The particular information I'm referring to comes from the 14words.net website on a page discussing Aryan or white spirituality. When I first read the article, I was struck with the truth contained in it, although the author clearly states at the beginning that this is simply his opinion based on his studies and insights. I felt he defined a major problem facing us as a race right now, and since I can't say it any better than he did in quoting Alfred Rosenberg from Race and Race History, I'll simply quote what he says. There are two values which embody the almost 2,000-year-old conflict between church and race: theology and belief, enforced belief, and pride in character. Two values which are rooted in will, and which are now battling for supremacy in Europe: love and honor. He goes on to state that love and honor cannot coexist and share the limelight. One will eventually become dominant, because honor is not always loving, and likewise love is not always honorable. He defines love as the love of humanity, or humanitarianism. Basically, the world we live in today of the Judeo-Christian tendency toward charity and love of all, despite any character flaws which might be present, which creates a society that accepts all people regardless of their character or background. A society based on love depends on the values imposed from outside to find or instill a sense of goodness in all of its citizens, and tends to take either a humanistic or an original sin approach to belief and judgment. It is based on the belief that all are created equal and have the same potential for growth and goodness, with the original sin component being the great leveler of all people. Its ultimate goal is to psychologically weaken anyone who has a high opinion of himself and produce people who are humble and love all of humanity, regardless of what they do or how they act. We've seen the horrible, disastrous results of living in this kind of society. Honor and integrity are ridiculed, and pride in oneself and one's race, especially if you're white, are not only mocked, but can have serious legal and even physical consequences. Please understand, I'm not talking about the Christianity of the past when absolute moral values existed and were honored, but about what passes for Christianity in this time and place and in this particular society. In essence, Judeo-Christianity. He then goes on to define honor as elitism, anarchism or fascism, and aesthetic or warlike tendencies towards self-overcoming. Anarchism in this context reflects the Aryan values of freedom and honor, where responsibility is placed solely on the head of the members of the society. Fascism is defined as the value of honor in that it seeks to place those who prove their honorable character and their excellence in a given field in the higher ranks of that field, thus recognizing that we are all not created equal. When honor is the defining characteristic of a society, as opposed to love, certain individuals stand above the majority in character, excellence, and honor, and they should be recognized and respected accordingly, rather than lowered to the standard of the rest of humanity. From honor comes other values such as freedom, responsibility, virility, nobility, individual integrity, and so forth. In a society based on honor, honor is the moral compass, and life is based on doing what is right from the heart and taking full responsibility for our actions. Of course, this type of society can only flourish when the majority of society holds the same values, as happens in a racially homogeneous society, since races left to develop on their own tend to hold many values in common. Healthy white societies of the past were based on the value of honor and excellence, not only in a given field of endeavor, but also personal excellence, was pursued with vigor and zeal. These societies formed men and women of character with many great accomplishments, where loss of personal honor meant loss of standing in society. This is in stark contrast to the societies of today, where anything goes, and honor and integrity are cast aside as being of no value, just so much baggage from the past. It is the value of honor that separates white spirituality and philosophy from that of all other races. It is also the value of honor combined with that of integrity, which separates white society from all others. Only in a society based on race and honor can a white man or woman reach his or her full potential. We, as a people and as individuals, need to recover our honor and our sense of integrity, both of which have been stolen from us by the society we have allowed the Jews to create. Yes, we have participated in our own demise in that we, as a race, have valued the admiration of others and being part of the group more than we have valued our own honor and integrity. It's time to step up to the plate and recognize that without our honor and integrity, we are nothing, because it is honor and integrity that ultimately define who we are. The Northwest Front is seeking men and women who put the values of honor and integrity first in their lives, and are willing to do what it takes to secure the existence of our race and create a future for white children, regardless of what anyone around them thinks. Men and women who have the vision of what an all-white society can really be. Are you one of them? If so, we look forward to seeing you here in the homeland soon, where we're working to achieve this vision. Hail victory, comrades!
Okay, like I mentioned last week, this week's podcast will be our official Adolf Hitler's birthday episode, insofar as we have one. This year, the Feiertag will mostly manifest itself here in music, and I'll try to avoid the usual scratchy military band recordings from the 1930s. Besides, I've already played the Horst Wessel lead on this show half a dozen times, and a while back, I read you that article that I did on Horst Wessel from the Weird Aryan History series. And I'll see if I can round you up something that sounds a little bit better on modern equipment, maybe some Saga, so forth and so on. Now, let me state up front here that I am a National Socialist, but in addition to getting stick for that from people of other religious and political viewpoints, I also get static from other comrades of my own faith because some of them considered me to be wishy-washy. I've compromised too much. I don't use the swastika openly, and some of them aren't happy about the level of coverage that I give NS topics on RFN and in my writings. I'm asked sometimes why I don't spend more time on big NS and Hitlerian programs and websites and try and have Hitler's birthday get-togethers here, so forth and so on, and I have several answers to that. One is that while I myself am a National Socialist, a lot of other white nationalists, including many Northwest independence-minded people, are not. And just as we try to avoid discussions of religion, I have no intention of trying to force my own personal ideology onto others. It's kind of like being a born-again Jesus freak. You need to have a personal experience with Adolf Hitler and accept him as your personal savior, so to speak. But also, there's something else. The simple fact is that we in modern times, and by that I mean we in our tiny little so-called movement, are not living up to Adolf Hitler's ideals, and I think every single one of us knows that he would be ashamed of us if he could see us and some of the things that we do in his name. For example, what do you think the real Führer would think about the drunken Glenn Miller who shot down three white people and then yelled Heil Hitler as the cops dragged him away? Now, I am a genuine National Socialist, and I have had to put up with these goddamned Hollywood Nazis for over 40 years now, and I'm getting sick of it. If some Jewish comedy writer in Hollywood was hired to write scripts that would make us look foolish and vicious and weak-minded and repulsive, he couldn't do a better job than we're doing to ourselves. Now, I get that there is a reason why a certain defective personality type seems to gravitate to the swastika and anything to do with the Third Reich, because of the obscene and stupid lies which have been told about Hitler's Germany that have become widely accepted as the truth. Now, this was always one of the worst things about what one might call Orthodox National Socialism back when I was practicing it. The fact that so many people seemed to want to join us because they believed all that happy horse manure about Hitler and the Third Reich and the Nazis, and they wanted to command their own concentration camp where they could flog busty Jewish maidens or invade Poland or something. In other words, they wanted to join us because of the stereotype and not in spite of it. And a lot of these young kids have never cracked a book in their lives, and they don't have the slightest idea what that swastika they've got tattooed on their arm or their chest really means. They just think it looks cool. And yes, it does. It was designed that way by one of the greatest propaganda minds who ever lived. And its appeal survives him. Now, I have received emails and letters from some of these knuckleheads actually signed Heil Hitler. And then there's the queers. I cannot count the times back when I was doing the Orthodox costumed gig that I would get letters from young men, obviously self-taken in their bedrooms, showing them wearing an SS officer's cap, a swastika armband, jack boots, and nothing else. Yes, Don, I got your message, and I'm going to talk about the queer thing later on in this show, but for now, suffice it to say that when the Northwest Front or the Northwest Republic ever does get to the point where uniforms are required, we need to avoid using any kind of leather. So, what does Adolf Hitler's birthday mean in 2014? Well, I'll tell you my own story. That's all I can do. I've always known that Hitler was right. Even when I was a child and I had no idea what National Socialism was all about, I seemed to have an instinctive recognition that all was not right in the society that I was growing up in, and that anyone whom the authorities of that society feared, hated, and reviled as much as Adolf Hitler had to have something going for him. And when I played army with the other boys in my Burlington, North Carolina neighborhood, I always wanted to fight on the German side. Nor was this unusual. There were other boys like myself who drew swastikas on their schoolbook covers and rooted for the Germans when watching television shows like Combat or the Gallant Men. There was something in the shape of that Teutonic coal scuttle helmet that thrilled our very souls. I've often wondered how this could be when we were so young that we could have no idea of the issues involved with the war or what the NSDAP was all about. And indeed, we were constantly subjected to a barrage of anti-NS propaganda in a time when the war was a very recent memory. I think that this was because there is a kind of innate moral faculty in our people that Aryans are born with, which instinctively recognizes the difference between truth and lies, between right and wrong. It's a pity more of us can't retain that faculty into our adult lives. Once I grew old enough to begin to understand things a bit, my earlier childish admiration and fascination with the Third Reich and the dynamic figure of Adolf Hitler grew, as I came to realize that my initial instincts had been correct. For one thing, even as a child reading my first books on the Second World War, I never bought into the Holocaust myth. I had no idea what the word logistics meant, but the idea that a nation fighting for its very existence would devote immense resources, manpower, and time to a pointless act of mass extermination was palpably ridiculous. I wrote the Holocaust story off as typical war propaganda, and I read on. Now, when I was about 10 years old, I met my first German war veteran, a friend of a friend of our family, a handsome and talented middle-aged artist from Greensboro, whom I will call Johann, in case he still lives. I didn't know it, but Johann had been a Fallschirmjäger during the war. That's a paratrooper. At a cocktail party one night, some loud-mouthed redneck was holding forth on how he'd whooped up on old Hitler and won the war single-handedly, and he was describing some battle in Italy, and he said, "And then the goddamn Nazi paratroopers came raining down out in the sky." And Johann looked up quietly from his corner and says, "Yeah, I remember. We jumped on you. You ran away." The redneck fool was noticeably silent for the rest of the evening. I was fascinated. Here was a man who had actually worn that helmet, that uniform with the eagle and swastika I had seen so often in movies and on TV. As soon as I could, I got Johann off to one side, and I asked him eagerly, "Did you ever meet Adolf Hitler?" "No, not personally," he replied with a smile. "But I saw him many times. I'm from Nuremberg, where they had the big rallies, and every year the Führer would drive beneath the window of my house in his open car. Once he looked up and saw me in the window, and he smiled. Later on, I was a Hitler youth, and I heard him speak." And then Johann was silent for a while, and he said, "When you heard his words, you knew that there was a God." Years later, I heard the words of Adolf Hitler, and I knew. I hear them still.
Oh, A History of the Tories. The Tories were the enemy of the American Revolution. After the Revolution, 65,000 of them went back to England. However, before they became known as the Tories, they were the Royalists, who fought against Parliament and the Roundheads in the English Civil War. After that war, Oliver Cromwell wrote a constitution for England, and in it he stated, "The right of Protestants to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." A French Protestant wrote The Social Contract, and it is from the social contract that we get our American democracy. Thomas Paine translated parts of The Social Contract into a pamphlet called Common Sense. Back in the old days, it was the common people who supported Protestantism. Even when I was in England, you could see the class division between the upper class and the commoners by what church they attended. The upper class in, say, the village of Crowland, on the Fens in East Anglia, would attend the Church of England. They would get about 10 in attendance. The commoners, on the other hand, would attend the Salvation Army Church. There, you would get about 200 in attendance. Oliver Cromwell did not support the establishment of a state church, because that could lead to the re-establishment of the Catholic Church as a state church, and the establishment of a state church would lead to the abolition of religious freedom. Disraeli started the new Conservative Party. So who was Disraeli? He was a Jew who became Prime Minister of England during the reign of Queen Victoria. You see, Jews are the Tories. Jews practice the Talmud, and in it they are taught to consider non-Jews or Gentiles as goyim or cattle. Lustchild is a Jew who lives in a palace near Birmingham, England. The upper class consider the lower classes as cattle, just as the Jews consider the Gentiles as cattle. So you can see that the Jews are the Tories. The problem here in America is that we have people who still believe that Jews who would join in working-class political parties such as, say, the Communist Party, are left-wingers or commoners. That's horseshit. The Jew is a Tory and has joined a working-class political party in order to deceive the worker and run the party for himself and his cronies, such as the bankers or his buddies at Wall Street. The Jews are a bunch of upper-class snobs, and the hatred of the Jew is exactly that, the hatred of the upper class. The American Revolution was fought by the English commoners against the upper-class Tories. It was a class war. If you don't hate the Jew, then you don't hate the Tories, and you don't support the American Revolution. You are a traitor to the American Revolution, and you don't even deserve to be called an American. America has become a country run by the Tories, who consider the working class to be cattle, and America is in desperate need for a revolution by the white working class to eradicate the Tories. Black people can become Tories. It is called brown nosing. Any black politician who bows down to the American-Israeli Political Action Committee has become a brown noser. The blacks call brown nosers Uncle Tom. The president's policies are 100% Tory. He bailed out the bankers. Got it? In fact, blacks will make themselves into Tories as soon as they get to power. They will stuff money into a Swiss bank account, build themselves a palace, just like Mugabe did, or make themselves into millionaires, just like the former president of Nigeria, all at taxpayer expense. And remember, the black African is making on average 100 times less than an American worker at minimum wage. Working for the benefit of your tribe at the expense of the nation is a form of Toryism. All black African nations are divided into tribes, and their policies become a form of tribal welfare. Civilization depends on leadership that will spend the taxpayers' money for the benefit of the nation, such as building roads or bridges or dams or water treatment or sewage, etc. But politicians who spend taxpayers' money on themselves or for the benefit of their own cronies will destroy civilization. In all third world countries, corruption is standard practice. The modern civilization we currently live under is the result of the high moral standards of Protestantism, or if you prefer, the white man's religion. The disappearance of the white man and his religion of Protestantism will lead to the disappearance of civilization. The Jews and their lefty loonies are supporting the abolition of religion because they are seeking the abolition of righteousness. Righteousness leads to evolution and civilization. The Jew seeks the destruction of righteousness because unrighteousness leads to tyranny. If belief in God can be abolished, then righteousness and liberty can be abolished. If there is a God, He created our world to evolve or heal itself. Evolution is a very slow process. Unfortunately, there are people who are expecting immediate results. It took over 300 years for Christianity to conquer the Roman Empire. The Germans lost the Second World War, but ideas cannot be conquered by war. Christianity was intensely persecuted during the 2nd century, but it survived and went on to conquer the Roman Empire. This is where faith comes in. We do not see the victory of evolution as yet, and things seem to be going backwards. But even leftists can become born-again evolutionists or national socialists. The truth that biology trumps all other considerations will eventually be the winner. Keep the faith. Time is on our side.
I got an email from Don in Salem. Dear HAC, what is with all the articles about faggots? I, for one, would like to see them exterminated, but I am certainly not interested in reading about them or their habits and history. I understand that this particular article is about Glenn Miller. I'm just sick of all the attention given to despicable deviants. Yeah, I get that response from people from time to time, and I agree it's a sickening subject. Okay, so why do I talk about buggery so much? Is it because I have some kind of weird obsession with it? No. By the way, if I might digress a bit, that is a common left liberal tactic that they use against so-called homophobes. They claim that anyone who publicly opposes so-called gay rights is a secret queer himself, which is a neat little semantic trick if you think about it. It's virtually impossible to refute. Now, faggot Republicans like Mark Foley and Senator Larry Twinkletoes Craig and the so-called gay mafia of priests that allegedly now runs the Vatican certainly tend to lend credibility to that stupid response. As in everything else with friends like these, normal white people don't need enemies. Okay, I want to get back to something I talked about a couple of months ago. Now, there are three lefty lib websites I urgently recommend that all of you start following regularly, as sickening as you will find it. These are Huffington Post, Salon Magazine, and Daily Beast. Here is where you will see the enemy in all his putrid Obama-like glory. Here is where you will see the agenda discussed openly and without shame. Here's where you will learn what these people are up to and what the Democrat Party has in store for us. Now, by the way, I really wish we had a better way to designate these people other than the left or lefty libs. It would really be far more accurate and to the point if we could get our own people to fall into the habit of referring to the enemy as the Democratic Party. Much simpler, much more descriptive, and so much easier for the muggles to wrap their minds around, since it's terminology they've actually been taught to use by the system itself, something they can easily see even in the state-controlled media. It's within their frame of reference, so to speak. It's we who have the problem with it. I say something like that, and it triggers the reflexive screams of, "Oh, the Republicans are just as bad." And yes, so they are. I can't really argue with that. Now, I've been trying to take our thinking a bit beyond that for some time now, and I haven't gotten much traction on it, but that's okay. These things take time. The idea of actually using these real-world political tropes against the system, kind of like a judo fighter using his opponent's own weight and momentum against him, is one that we aren't able to wrap our minds around yet. We prefer to hunker down in our little cyber caves on the internet and wait for Adolf Hitler or George Lincoln Rockwell or the mothership or whatever to descend from Valhalla and miraculously lead us all down the street in long marching columns, just like it was 1933, and of course we don't actually have to do anything that involves risk or inconvenience. This is what I refer to as our movement habit of waiting for Godot, and if that reference is a little too complex for some of you, I'm sorry, look it up. But it really does mean something when I say that essentially all we're doing is we're sitting around waiting for Godot. Never mind, I'll come back to the idea of involving ourselves in real-world politics, and I'll keep plugging away. Like I said, I haven't gotten much traction on it so far, but we'll get it eventually. Okay, where was I? Oh, yeah, why do I talk about faggots so much? Right. I say again, start reading these three websites I mentioned, although it will enrage you to the point where you want to start throwing things at the walls. You will note that on any given day, these sites are one-third to one-half about faggots and faggotry. And true, some of these articles are physically sickening. I don't ask you to read them all word for word, but I say again, here is where you will see the agenda out in the open. Here is where you will read what they have in store for us. Right now, homosexuality is arguably the biggest single item on the agenda which the lefty-lib Democrats, the ruling party, the media power structure, whatever you want to call it, is pushing on everybody, not just Americans. Being a pervert is now hip. It's trendy. As with the niggers, these people don't just want equality, they want superiority over normal people. And they're getting it. Now, it might well be argued that right now homosexuality is America's main cultural export. The dictatorship and the media here are starting to push it onto the rest of the world to the point where even third world countries like Nigeria, Uganda, and India are fighting back and reaffirming or reviving their old buggery statutes in order to fight this spew of homosexual propaganda and entertainment coming out of the United States. And you remember where all this latest round of anti-Russian hatred and propaganda we're seeing in the media these days really started? Long before the Olympics, long before the business in the Ukraine, it was when Vladimir Putin came out against sodomy and Russia passed a stiff new law prohibiting it. Now that's when all the howling about wicked, evil Russia really started. And that's why we have one faction of our ruling party howling for war with Russia right now, no matter how utterly insane the idea is, and no matter how utterly incapable the United States military is of taking on anybody who might fight back. There are apparently very serious elements in the ultra-liberal, ultra-left wing of the Democrat hierarchy who believe that we have to go invade Russia and Iran and Syria and Uganda and God knows where else so that perverted men will be able to fuck each other in the ass with impunity. That's a hell of a foreign policy, isn't it? The liberal left Democrats have gotten so bad they're even cyber-lynching their own celebrities on Twitter and so forth for political incorrectness if any of them make a verbal slip that might be construed as anti-buggery. Prime example is former liberal icon Alec Baldwin, who got run off MSNBC, of all places, because one day he was being harassed on the street by a paparazzi and he lost his temper and he called the guy a faggot, although that wasn't the actual word he used. And the paparazzi recorded it on tape, or rather on his cell phone, I should say. The actual word was kind of fuzzy on the audio, and Baldwin tried for some days to deny that he even said it, but it just wouldn't wash. Big Lib Baldwin was given no benefit of the doubt at all. All that stuff he'd been doing for the liberal left-wing cause for decades didn't count a bit. He got fired in what the liberals refer to as an act of economic discipline, their term. That's how they enforce ideological and sexual conformity in this society. You either toe the line and love thy nigger and love thy faggot and never dare to utter so much as a peep of protest, or else you will be denied the right to make a living. America doesn't really need a Stalin-style secret police, although more and more we have one anyway. The power structure threatens white Americans in their one most vulnerable spot, in their stuff. If you dare to be a racist or a homophobe or a Christian, or even if you dare to listen to Rush Limbaugh, the liberals will cut off your job, cut off your money, and cause you to lose your precious stuff. Threaten his stuff, and an American white boy will fold like a lawn chair. So far, the only individual who has successfully stood up to the economic discipline of the Democrats is Phil Robertson from Duck Dynasty. But Phil is already a millionaire, and he's a simple man who doesn't need celebrity or adoration. And if Duck Dynasty goes, then Arts and Entertainment Network goes, and so basically the millions won out, and he was able to tell the economic discipline hit crew to go piss off. For now. But I'm sure he's still on their hit list somewhere. The French philosopher Voltaire once wrote, "If ever you desire to know who really controls a society, find out who it is that you are forbidden to criticize." In this society, it's always been Jews we were forbidden to criticize, and for the past 50 years or so, niggers, and now it's faggots, who are officially a politically protected minority and immune from any criticism or adverse comment on their behavior to the point where anyone who makes such comment will be punished. I make nasty comments about faggots for the same reason I do a lot of things, Don, because America forbids me to do so, and anything that America forbids us white boys from doing is something that we should be devoting a large part of our time to doing. Talking about homosexuality in a negative way is important for us to do, Don, because it's clearly very important to the enemy. and we need to be doing things that actually make the enemy uncomfortable and upset, even if all we can manage to accomplish that with is words right now. Speaking of words, now let's talk about the B word itself and why I use it. Now, the cruel and brutal fact of the matter is that we no longer live in times of decency and cleanliness, nor will any of us ever see them again in our lifetimes unless we finally break brave. We are not going to wake up suddenly one morning and find that some benevolent god with a white beard sitting on a throne in the clouds has decided to be kind and reward all our effort and our suffering by waving his almighty scepter and turning back the clock to the days of the Brady Bunch. If we will stop fooling around and wasting our time and effort, if we will stiffen our spines and act instead of talking and hiding behind computers, then it is possible that our children may live to see some kind of return to sanity and normalcy. Few of us will ever know such a time. Most of us will end our lives in a situation roughly similar to that of Lebanon, Yugoslavia, or Rwanda, right here in this North American continent. And amidst all the violence, disease, starvation, and chaos, there's going to be a good deal of sexual perversion. Not the least, buggery. The glorification of perversion, what our media masters have even come to call defining deviancy down, is a staple on the agenda. It is dished up right in our faces. My occasional references to sodomy are nothing at all compared to one single night of television of Ellen and all the other filth that the Jews shovel into our living rooms in an unending flow of raw sewage. My own occasional excursions into the nomenclature of the perverse are mild, very mild indeed, Don, by comparison. So, you ask, why do us supposedly superior Aryan revolutionary types have to, quote-unquote, lower ourselves to that level? Well, I'll tell you why. It has to do with the same reason why I cannot ignore corruption, deceit, and malfeasance in the movement. Because if we are to prevail, we must be first and foremost a movement of truth. And a large part of that truth consists in exposing that which our enemies wish to conceal, gloss over, and camouflage. The truth is that homosexuality is a loathsome and physically sickening perversion, the hygienic aspects of which alone are sufficient to make a normal person vomit. The establishment seeks to cloak these practices on the part of their pet perverts in abstractions about expressing love and lifestyle, and to a large extent, they have succeeded. People have been conditioned by years of constant media pounding, forcing these perverts down our throats. We've been conditioned to believe that homosexuals are a persecuted minority. There have even been quasi-scientific efforts to prove, quote-unquote, that perversion is somehow genetic and that faggots can't help their innate and irresistible biological urge to cornhole. Now, this is rubbish. Homosexuality is a behavior and a filthy one. And we should never, ever neglect to make this point to our own people. Normal people might be swayed by their innate Aryan sense of fairness to give the little guy a break, so long as they're not compelled to confront just what it is homosexuals do. When they understand what it is that homosexuals do, when they forget all the horse manure about gay rights and homophobia and blah, 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 and think in terms of sodomy, assorted practices with bizarre objects, leather and chains and whips and something lesbians call the chocolate ritual, which I will leave to the imagination, and when they understand that a large part of the so-called gay rights movement has the goal of gaining access to children for these creatures so that they can introduce these filthy practices to their kids, then the overwhelming majority of white people and third worlders as well will react with shock, horror, and anger, as they should. Homosexuality is a shocking and unnatural act, utterly beyond the bounds of human decency, and we must not allow this to be forgotten. Hence my references to faggots, fudge packers, carpet munchers, etc. Yes, this language is crude and offensive to many. Homosexuality is offensive to me, and to everyone with any rudimentary remaining healthy instincts. Yes, it is true that for every one of these terms, there is a circumlocution which can be used in what passes for polite society. Indeed, we hear these terms repeatedly every night on our televisions. Now, that's one reason why we must not allow ourselves to be sucked into the trap of being polite as opposed to being accurate. These politically correct circumlocutions sanitize a nauseating and poisonous perversion, and Joe Sixpack has by now been so dumbed down that he is incapable of seeing past the sanitized versions of what homosexuals do, unless we rub his nose in it. George Orwell wrote in 1984 about the abuse of language by totalitarian Marxist politically correct regimes, such as the one we live under today. Now, the idea behind making certain words unacceptable or beyond the pale of discussion is to so restrict the available language in which to discuss certain ideas that the state can thus restrict and repress the thought. Dissident thoughts cannot be formulated if people are deprived through intimidation or through a mistaken sense of delicacy of the necessary, accurate words to describe them. Blacks, for example, are not African Americans out here in the real world. They've never been anywhere near Africa. They are niggers. They act like niggers. They steal and kill like niggers. They booga booga like niggers. They are niggers. And yet nowadays, the mere use of that word in public is enough to destroy a white male's life in every conceivable way. The system does not dare allow us to say the word nigger. Indeed, it has created such a repressive atmosphere around the word that most of us are now even afraid to think the word, so it's working. This is mind control, no more, no less. And the same kind of mind control is being used to suppress white consciousness regarding what homosexuals do and why they are loathsome, unnatural perverts. Why they must be kept away from our children by whatever means necessary. We must not allow the racial enemy to set the parameters of what is and is not acceptable for Americans to discuss. Especially given the increasingly abysmal standard of education and political literacy among our Beavis and Butthead Homer Simpson population. And when it comes to conveying any idea at all to Americans, never forget how low you have to aim in order to get a hit. The whole homosexuality issue is not a legal or a social one. It is a moral one. But we cannot convince others of that unless we constantly keep before their eyes the sickening vision of what it is that homosexuals do. Now, this is why I use these terms. I try not to go too far overboard, but inevitably I offend some people, and I apologize for that, but it's necessary, just like pain is unavoidable when one is extracting a bullet from a wound. Okay. Now I suppose I should replay Cheech and Chong's Buggery on the High Seas, but I won't defile the Fuhrer's birthday with smut from a Mexican Hoppa stand-up comic team. Instead, here's Saga. I've often imagined that if a movie is ever made out of any of my novels, this would be the song played on the soundtrack as the first Northwest Tricolor goes up over Longview. It's a scene that I think the Fuhrer would enjoy as he looks down from Valhalla or whatever part of the celestial realm where he now resides.
Thank you. and its cradle is closing his eyes, and the blossom embraces the pea. But soon sets the whisper, rise, arise, tomorrow belongs to me. Show us the sign your children have been waiting to see. The morning will come when the world is mine. Tomorrow belongs to me. And tomorrow belongs to me.
In my effort to find something a little off the beaten path for this week's Feuertag episode, I came across this old article from 1996 hidden away on my hard drive. Now, I usually post this on Thought Crime at Christmas time, but I don't think it's inappropriate for Dad's birthday. Now, there are times when it seems beyond doubt that we are living in the age of the triumph of evil. And believe it or not, there is still some good left in the world. Not much. And on the rare occasions when it shows itself, goodness must peep up from its hiding place like a cautious groundhog and generally pop back underground very quickly to avoid the swooping predators. But every now and then we get a glimpse. Now, on October the 31st, 1996, Herbert Perry, a retired businessman in Durham, North Carolina, suffered a stroke. He recovered in hospital, and in November, he was sent to the Hillcrest Convalescent Home. He had a roommate, an 88-year-old man named Helmut Bartsch, who had been on a visit from Germany to his married daughter in Durham and who had also suffered a stroke on October 25th. At first, the two elderly gentlemen didn't talk much, but then Perry's son-in-law brought him some of his effects from home, including a bedside clock with a B-17 bomber on top. It turned out that the two roomies had something in common. "Ah, I remember that silhouette," spoke up Bartsch when he saw it. "I remember the sound, too, like a hammer of Smith's, crack, crack, crack." Over 50 years ago, Herbert Perry was a corporal in the Army Air Corps in England, an air traffic controller. Helmut Bartsch was across the channel in Normandy, commanding an anti-aircraft battery in the Wehrmacht. "I put him up, he shot him down," commented Perry to a local news reporter. "We're very similar, even though we're enemies," continued Perry. "He had a stroke on the right side, I had a stroke on the left side. Now we talk about our days in the army. Every time he gets a little blue, we sing a German hymn." "The newspapers were always reporting air attacks on small towns," said Bartsch, explaining why he volunteered for anti-aircraft. "It was only my duty to serve in the army." Herbert Perry lost a lot of friends among the air crews he sent up into the sky heading for Germany, many of them never to return. But he never let himself become bitter, and he has always maintained a deep respect for the German people and their culture and intellect. "I even said it back during the war. The German people were smart, and if the Americans hadn't come to England, Hitler would have conquered them." The two families are now friends, and the old vets will be staying in touch after Bartsch returns to Stuttgart. The second part of this piece concerns another old veteran from the war. Now remember, this was written 18 years ago, and Mr. Ferguson is almost certainly dead now. Crawford J. Ferguson of Charlotte, North Carolina, is 72 years old. Half a century ago, Crawford T. Ferguson was part of a B-17 crew that flew 35 missions over Germany in 1944, raids which slaughtered untold hundreds of thousands of people. For 50 years, it has haunted his sleep. "I keep seeing plumes of fire down below as the cities fall apart, and at the same time it's like I'm down in the city, burning, running through the flames, looking for a child or a wife or a sister," Ferguson told a reporter. "I have known for years that there was something I had to do before I die." What Ferguson had to do was apologize, and this year he did. He wrote out a total of 13 letters, about 100 words each, and addressed them to the city hall in every German town his plane had ever bombed: Berlin, Bremen, Cologne, Frankfurt, Kassel, Hamburg, Munich, and others not revealed in the news article. In each letter, he put a simple, heartfelt apology for what he had done in 1944. Our target was strategic, but innocent lives were lost, citizens maimed and civilian property destroyed. I beg forgiveness for the agony I helped inflict upon you. The first few letters got some publicity in Germany. The mayor of Kassel sent Ferguson a thank you note, and the local newspaper printed the apology. A weekly TV news program called Hessene Schau picked up the story and ran a feature on it. Ferguson also received a letter from the Munich City Council requesting permission to make his letter public, which he granted. The mayor of Munich, Christian Udi, wrote a personal letter of thanks. Then something odd happened. About half of Ferguson's letters got through, but six of them appear to have been intercepted and returned by the German federal postal authorities without explanation, possibly because they were deemed to contain Nazi propaganda. Ferguson says with wry humor, "I wrote to our beloved President Bill Clinton. I sent the letters to him, and I told him that they had been returned. I invited him to read them, and if he thought they merited being forwarded, I was going to rely on him to take care of the situation. I still haven't heard back from him." Now, this third bit is one of the saddest of all. I read this in a British newspaper sometime in the early 1980s when I was actually living there, and I cannot remember all the details. I'm going to quote this from memory as best I can. In a small village in the Norfolk Fen country is a war memorial cemetery for the local dead in both wars. In one corner stands a small white obelisk bearing a Luftwaffe eagle and swastika. In the early 1980s, some of the anti-fascist scum came up from London to squawk and deface and attempt to destroy the headstone. The police and a number of local men came to the cemetery and saw them off, apparently none too gently. The Antifas scurried back to London screaming about police brutality and right-wing vigilantes. In the course of reporting this, the press also retold how the stone came to be there. In 1944 and 1945, a lot of British and American air groups were operating out of fairly small airfields all across East Anglia. One such was this place in Norfolk. One day, there was a massive daylight raid against what was left of Hamburg, using planes from all over the various fields. They dropped their loads of death, and they were headed home when they ran into a number of German fighters. We broke up and flew our separate ways back to base, but there was this one German who stuck with us and wouldn't give up, recalled an American pilot. He shot down at least two planes in our group and probably some more when the dogfight first began, but we just couldn't shake him. Our radio operator spoke some German, and he could hear this guy's flight commander ordering him to come back. He would run out of fuel if he didn't. But the German pilot told him something like, "You saw what they did today. They left nothing. I have nothing to go back to." Evidently, we'd bombed this guy's house, probably killed his family. We dodged into a cloud formation, and for a while we thought we'd lost him. But over the coast of Holland, we had to drop down and get our bearings, and there he was, still on our tail, still shooting at us, shredding us up pretty bad, and wounding two of our crew. Our gunners shot back, but could never hit him. Damn if the SOB didn't chase us all the way back to England. Our flak opened up on him as we came over the English coast, but they missed. By the time we got back to our field, he had two British Spitfires on his tail, but they couldn't seem to tag him either. The guy seemed bulletproof. I got her down, and we all jumped out of the aircraft and ran like hell, dragging our wounded with us. And he crashed his Messerschmitt right into our B-17. He finally got us, even though it was at the cost of his own life. His plane didn't catch fire because his fuel tanks were bone dry. He must have been flying on fumes. When they pulled him out of the wreckage, dead, it was this blonde kid, couldn't have been more than 19 or 20. He didn't have any papers on him, and we never learned his name. The incident had been witnessed by the local villagers, who were so impressed by the boy's courage that the vicar offered him a burial plot in the church's war cemetery, where he lies to this day, unknown. Now, all of the above is quoted from memory, but one thing I do remember with absolute accuracy, because I wrote these words down, and that is the epitaph on that young hero's grave in an enemy land. They were composed by an RAF colonel who also witnessed his death. "Call them misguided, call them even wicked if you must, but no nation or cause ever brought forth defenders of greater courage and worth. They fought like the Northland gods of their ancient and warlike race, and few indeed are those among us who can say that ever we saw their backs. And when the British media asked the local people why they defended the grave of a Nazi, one of them answered, "We don't care who he was. We just know that he was a brave lad who one morning flew all the way from Germany to our village to die here because he thought it was right that he do so. He is one of us now. And when those yobs come up here from London and insult his memory, they insult us and all our own dead as well. They weren't even alive during the war. They don't know what it was like back then. Why the hell don't they just bloody well belt up?" Now, these are the true words of the men who were there, who fought the Jews' war for them, and who are far more entitled to speak of that time and those other men than any Deborah Lipstadt or Ken McVeigh or howling, slobbering rich Graves. I have met many men down through the years who were veteran of that war, and I never pass up a chance to see if I can get them to speak of their experiences. And while I have to concede that there is a great deal of hatred remaining among those who fought against the Japanese, I have never met a single genuine combat veteran of any Allied army, American, Canadian, British, or South African, who fought against the Germans and who did not speak with respect and admiration of their courage, their skill, and devotion as soldiers, and their human qualities of fortitude, humor, and compassion in victory and in defeat. If there are those who can't handle this view of Nazis, then I recommend you start with some of the accounts left by Allied veterans of the First War. Robert Graves's goodbye to all that springs to mind, but there are many other examples. As for these hate-filled reptiles at the Simon Wiesenthal Center and the ADL and the AFA and NISCOR, I can only quote again the little old English lady. Why don't they just bloody well belt up? Why indeed? Okay, running long, so one more quick comment on several emails I've been receiving over the past week regarding the so-called victory of the Cowboys at the Bundy Ranch in Nevada. Now, I'm not trying to detract from this or downplay the achievement. Yes, it was a victory. And God knows those are rare enough for us. Mr. Bundy got his cattle back, the militarized police and the federal hoodlums in the black body armor retreated, and Dingy Harry Reid is now exposed as the corrupt Democrat who was behind it all because he wanted that so-called government land to sell to the Chinese. So he had his flunkies in the Bureau of Land Management just seize it. And as an additional little earner on the side, he had them steal Cliveden Bundy's cattle and try to sell them, fully confident that nothing would be done about it. When the potential for another Waco or Ruby Ridge in an election year became apparent, someone from deep within the inner bowels of the dictatorship ordered Dingy Harry to back off. And as you can tell from his subsequent ranting and raving press conferences, he's spittin' mad. Now, that having been said, I very much doubt it's over. Now, you can bet that the Internal Revenue Service and the United States Attorney in Las Vegas are now going over every aspect of the Bundy family's lives with a microscope. My official prediction is that sometime after the November midterm elections, a federal grand jury will be quietly convened. Secret sealed indictments for some idiotic made-up crime or other will be handed down, and there will be midnight raids on the Bundy Ranch in the homes of the so-called militia leaders. And most likely some people are going to end up shot in the back of the head like Gordon Call, and that Arkansas sheriff who protested against the FBI's murder of Call, and that poor dumb Chechen bastard in Orlando a year ago that the FBI murdered in his apartment. Now, those who do not end up dead will end up sitting in prison cells for life alongside Uri Call and Edgar Steele and Bill White. Like all dictatorships, the dictatorship under which we live cannot allow anyone to be seen to defy them successfully. That's real politic, as the Germans call it. Now, guys, if we're going to do this, we have to go all the way. Any so-called victory or solution that allows the present power structure to remain intact and able to pay armed men to do their bidding will end only in a river of blood. Sorry, but that's the way it is. But our time is up now, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sascha Andaban. Freedom. Oh, what the hell. I'll give you some military music after all. This is the Hohenfriedberger March, the Hills of Peace, composed by Frederick the Great of Prussia.